Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. A week after California's primary election, there are still a number of local and statewide races hanging in the balance. Ahead on Insight, we'll get an update on the latest results. Also, the 1976 Republican primary battle between Gerald Ford and former California Governor Ronald Reagan was bitter, personal, and ultimately transformational for the GOP. We'll speak with the creator for the new podcast Landslide about how a primary race almost 50 years ago shook up politics and opened up a partisan divide that continues today. Finally, a Sacramento-born and raised writer has earned a James Beard Award for her debut cookbook of Puerto Rican recipes with the goal of preserving the diaspora. The author behind Diasporican joins us. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been just over a week since California held its primary election, and votes are still being tallied. Sacramento County still has over 80,000 ballots left to go, and the state is reporting over 1.2 million unprocessed ballots, both as of yesterday afternoon. Confirmed results are still likely days or even weeks away. The Secretary of State's office will certify the results in April. But while the count is still ongoing, there have been some shakeups on the local level, especially in the race for Sacramento mayor. And on the state level, Governor Gavin Newsom's multi-billion-dollar mental health plan Prop 1 is still sitting on a razor's edge. Here to break down the latest developments are CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb and politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Good afternoon, you two.
Hello.
Hey, Vicky.
All right, so let's start local. Kristen, so the Sacramento mayoral race, I mean, there was a pretty significant change in the totals after yesterday's vote drop. What did we see?
Epidemiologist Flo Kofer rose to first place. She's over 2,000 votes ahead of former state lawmaker Dr. Richard Pan, who has the second most votes. And Pan has 155 more votes than state assembly member Kevin McCarty, who's in third. And McCarty has 163 more votes than former city council member Steve Hansen.
Wow. So what have we seen in the vote count over the past week?
Last Wednesday, the order of the four major candidates was Pan in first, followed by Hansen, McCarty in third, and Kofer in fourth. So Kofer has really shaken that up in the past two results update. It's still a tight race, though, with roughly 2,400 votes separating the candidate in first and the one in fourth.
It's important to remember this was a race that had the potential to be decided on the primary if a single candidate received more than 50% of the vote. It doesn't seem like that will be the case, but is that still possible? I mean, what are the implications if this race goes to a runoff with top two?
Yeah, it's likely we'll have that November runoff, and it'll be interesting to see who the top two are. From there, they'll have to win over voters who supported the other candidates, you know, when we've got this kind of like about 23% split. And how much the top two candidates differ politically could really shape the messaging and outreach. Like, if these early results as of yesterday hold, we could be looking at Kofer versus Pan, with Kofer being the most progressive candidate, while Pan is more right of center, especially when it comes to police and homelessness.
Another big race was for Sacramento City Council District 4. That encompasses the city center as well as East Sacramento. And that was between challenger Phil Pluckybaum and the incumbent Katie Valenzuela. What do the results look like today?
Pluckybaum has a lead of about 1,500 votes, or 12%, over Valenzuela. This time last week, he had a lead of 19%. So the gap has narrowed, but he still has a significant lead. And countywide, there are still roughly 84,000 ballots left to process, but it's unclear how many votes are left to count for this specific city race.
Yeah. Well, what does this swing in results for both the mayoral and District 4 race, what does it suggest about voting behavior during elections?
It's possible that younger, more progressive voters turn in their ballots later than older, more conservative voters, just based on their campaigns. Both Kofer and Valenzuela's biggest and most vocal supporters are younger and more progressive compared to their competitors. And both of them have seen gains in the later results updates.
Yeah, well, according to these current results, which are still preliminary, what does voter turnout look like so far in Sacramento?
The voter data firm Political Data Inc. puts citywide voter turnout at 38% right now. That's with roughly 105,000 of 274,000 mailed ballots returned. And that's a little bit higher than for all of Sacramento County. The elections office shows that there's about a 20% turnout rate for registered voters as of right now.
Okay, so I mean, Sacramento County is at 28%, but 38% for citywide in the city of Sacramento is pretty good, given that statewide the return rate so far is 30%. So, I mean, that kind of might indicate that there's more engagement in citywide races, which also brings me back to District 4. I mean, what stood out to you about the participation rate for this specific council district?
Yeah, Political Data Inc. says that the rate is at 51% right now and could get higher. When I spoke with Valenzuela on election night, she said that she thinks that if she loses, she doesn't think it would be because people didn't know that there was an election happening. I know that both she and Plucky Bomb really walked those precincts over the past year. And Valenzuela has faced both criticism and praise during her time on the council. She could be described as a bit divisive in the area. And downtown and midtown area has really seen the impacts of COVID and the rise in homelessness locally. Businesses and residents in this district are very vocal at public meetings. And East Sac has always been a pretty politically engaged area. And for many residents there, it's the first time that they've been able to vote since 2018 because of redistricting.
This wasn't the only city council race, though, for the city of Sacramento. Have there been any big changes to the other districts?
The other two contested races haven't really changed. Eric Guerra is still likely to win re-election outright in District 6. That's the Tahoe Park, Colonial Heights area. He has 67% of the vote right now. And the top two candidates for District 2, Sean Lois, former council member Sean Lalois' district. The top two candidates are Roger Dickinson with 46% and Stephen Walton, who trails with 16%.
Finally, Kristen, there was also a measure on the ballot, Measure C, and this was a business tax, which the city says hasn't been updated since 1991. Where does that stand today?
It's still looking like it'll fail with no votes at 61%. There's a difference of about 15,000 votes between no and yes votes for this update to the business operations tax.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're getting updates on the latest results from last week's primary. So we just heard from CAP Radio's Kristen Lamb about Sacramento citywide races. Now we're going to turn to CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon for a statewide look. Okay, Nicole, so one of the biggest races was Prop 1 that was lobbied heavily by Governor Newsom. It includes a $6.4 billion mental health plan, among other changes. What is Prop 1 in terms of voter returns? What is it looking like today?
Well, today it is very close. It's technically 50-50 split. There's only 4,000 votes separating the yes from the no vote. So very close. But since election night, it's been slightly up. It's had that lead of less than 1% the entire time. And yesterday, the no on Prop 1, so people fighting against this ballot measure, actually conceded. So it's interesting that they said this will likely pass. Then today, it's so close. But if you look at the ballots left to process, there's about 1.2 million ballots left to count around the state. A third of them are from counties like Los Angeles, Santa Clara, Alameda. Those are places where Prop 1 is way up. So I think it is, even though it's very close right now, it likely will stay in the lead.
Given that the Californians Against Prop 1, you know, issued a formal statement of concession, and you just touched upon it, I mean, could it be premature, just given I understand that the counties that where a lot of the ballots still need to be counted, you know, they are heavily impacted by homelessness, but yeah, it still seems just really slim to make a formal concession like that.
It was interesting timing. I think that, you know, the trends show that I mean, anything could happen. But based on the ballots left to count, it looks like this will end up passing. It is interesting that they did concede and the governor has yet to say anything on this.
Yeah, you've also talked about this as well. I mean, there was a disparity in election funding and backers between supporters of Prop 1 and opponents of Prop 1. You know, with the disparity, the heavy funding going to supporting Prop 1, I mean, is this closeness, could it even be interpreted as a loss for Governor Newsom, just given how close and razor thin it is right now?
I mean, if it passes, I think the governor will be happy about that. But I think it is surprising that, you know, Newsom spent $12 million from his own ballot measure campaign on this, and it had support from other groups, law enforcement, NAMI and psychiatrist groups spent money in support of this. So, and then on the other side, the No on Prop 1 campaign had $1,000. So, yes, the fact that this is so close and that Newsom went on a statewide tour the weekend before the election to promote this, had ads for it, it is surprising. I think one thing to keep in mind is that the governor pitched this as, you know, more housing for mentally ill people and veterans. And while that is a huge part of this, it's not quite that simple. There were some very complicated changes to the Mental Health Services Act for how local governments can spend their behavioral health budgets. And there were concerns from some progressive voter blocs about how Prop 1 could lead to more people locked in mental health facilities into forced treatment. So there were concerns from, you know, more conservative voters and I think more progressive voters on this.
Is there the possibility of a recount?
It's interesting. I was talking to somebody about this yesterday because it has been so close and I got curious. So I looked up California's election recount rules. There is no provision for an automatic recount in California, which kind of surprised me. If somebody wants a recount, they have to request it and they have to pay for it, which I assume is a huge barrier in a state this big. The governor can order a state-funded recount only if the margin on a statewide elected office or a ballot measure is 1,000 votes or less. That is crazy low for a state this big, in my opinion. I mean, Prop 1 is like 50-50 right now, and it's 4,000 votes. So there are other states, many other states do have provisions for automatic or requested recounts if the election results are within like 0.5% or 0.25%. But on the other hand, doing a recount for a statewide election in a state this big, it would be huge and very expensive. So Prop 1 is so close right now, you know, that it's about 50-50, but it still does not reach that margin where the governor could call for a recount. And if it's up, he has no incentive to do that anyway.
Yeah. Well, of course, there's another big statewide race, which is the race for Senate. I mean, the AP has already called the race for Congressmember Adam Schiff, as well as the Republican candidate Steve Garvey. But it is interesting to see how votes continue to be counted as they come in. So what do the percentages look like right now?
Yeah, this was kind of another interesting update. Today, Steve Garvey actually jumped into the lead on the Senate race at 32%. Adam Schiff is barely in second, 31.9%. There's like a 5,000 vote difference. And, you know, the reason for this likely is that, you know, Steve Garvey, he was out. He was featured in Adam Schiff's campaign ads. He was like seen as the Republican in the race. Meanwhile, like Kristen had talked about, younger voters, more progressive voters tend to turn in their ballots late. And you've seen the results for Barbara Lee and Katie Porter kind of go up a bit since election night. So meanwhile, the Republicans that are turning in their ballots later are going for Steve Garvey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've kind of leached some support from Adam Schiff during these later batch results.
Yeah. A confusing part of the ballot, too, was that we had to vote twice for senator. So, I mean, is there hypothetically a possibility that we could get one of these candidates for the partial term, which is only like a few weeks, and then the other candidate for the entire term?
I guess, you know, hypothetically we could, but I highly doubt that would happen. You know, this special election will also go to the general election, in which case, you know, the very heavily Democratic voters of California will probably send Adam Schiff for those 2 weeks of the partial term before sworn in for the full term. But the reason, again, I want to review this, that you have Senate candidates appearing twice on your ballot is a relatively new state law. It stipulates that if one of California's U.S. senators vacates their seat, the governor may appoint a replacement, which he did. LaFonza Butler holds that seat currently. She decided not to run for another full term. And this law also stipulates that that replacement will hold the seat as a successor until another successor can be chosen by voters at the next general election. So because this happens so late in the term, it's weird. But you know, imagine if a senator were to vacate the seat a year into their term. Voters would want the chance to weigh in on that so that the governor's not appointing somebody who's then holding that seat for 5 years.
Right. There are also statewide races at the state capitol, the legislature, and we had some close ones and some interesting ones, competitive ones even, you know, in our area. How are those shaking out?
Those haven't moved much since election night. In the 6th Assembly District, it looks like Democrat Maggie Krell and Republican Nikki Ellis will face off in November for that Assembly seat held by Kevin McCarty. We've talked about this Senate seat in San Joaquin County where two well-known Democrats were trying to advance from the primary, Jerry McNerney and Carlos Villapudua, against one Republican. Well, not super surprising, the Republican in that race, Jim Shoemaker, has 41% of the vote, and then McNerney and Villapudua were kind of vying for that second place spot. And McNerney is up 34%, so it looks like he and the Republican in that race will go to the general election, which is a loss for Villapudua, who spent some time in the legislature. And then quickly, other incumbents, Republican Josh Hoover in eastern Sacramento County, Heath Flora, Stephanie Wynn, in the legislature, they'll all face challengers in November.
Finally, when we did our primary coverage, I mean, there was a concern about having low voter turnout, potentially it being a historical low, because I think on primary election night, less than 20% of the ballots were returned, which, you know, when you compare it to previous presidential primary years, was low, but we are still getting more ballots in. So what does the turnout look like now?
Right now, it's about 30%. The previous low was in 2012, and that was a hair over 31%. So it looks like with 1.2 million ballots left to count, I think it's safe to say we will not set that record for new record for low voter turnout, which is good. But I don't think we'll see it at that like 45% that we sometimes see in primaries.
Yeah, I don't know if we should be celebrating, you know, right. a third of registered voters returning their ballots. Nicole and Kristen, thank you.
Thanks.
That was CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb and politics reporter Nicole Nixon. They've been giving us an update on the latest results from California's presidential primary election, which was held last week. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The 2024 presidential primary is heading towards deja vu. Barring any major or unexpected twists and turns, the potential for Trump versus Biden is strong. Whether most Americans want the rematch is up for debate. While the general election is still several months away, we're going to go back in history and look at another race that has many of the hallmarks of today's. The year was 1976. The political climate was intensely bitter and partisan. The country's direction was hanging in the balance. There was division, a full-fledged culture war, and many of the same political issues we argue about today were at stake even back then. A new podcast contends that the 1976 election directly led to today's gulf between the parties. If you're a part of that generation, this might sound all too familiar.
The State of the Union is not good.
The energy crisis has developed into a money crisis.
Gasoline lines and empty pumps.
The second day in a row, snipers fired at a school bus as the controversy over textbooks continued.
And that podcast is called Landslide. It is part of the NPR network, and former Cap Radio reporter Ben Bradford is the creator and host. Ben joins us now to discuss the connections between 1976 and today and the role of a former California governor and especially how he became president. Thank you for joining us, Ben.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So before we get into the podcast, let's get to your history here at Cap Radio. Tell us about your time here and what you've been up to since then.
Yeah, absolutely. So I spent 3 years as a state politics reporter, actually in Nicole's job. It was nice to hear her. She's much more eloquent than I am. So nice to see you guys got an upgrade there. And after that, I moved to Marketplace. I was a reporter for Marketplace. And I just all the way along, though, starting at Capital Public Radio, I'd been really interested in our political divide. And so I left Marketplace to start doing these kinds of narrative history series. And we're currently talking about my second one.
So Landslide is the name of your newest podcast. I mean, you teamed up with NPR for this. How did this come about?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I started to get the kind of the seed of the idea back when I was in Sacramento, and it was during the 2016 election. And I would covered Donald Trump's campaign a little bit, including some of his campaign rallies in Sacramento. And in many ways, I think it felt ahistorical to me. And obviously the divide in the country became so apparent. And so I got kind of obsessed with how we got there. And eventually I left Marketplace because I said, I think I can create something compelling about this, and began researching and looking at the history and said, oh, well, maybe it's not as ahistoric as I thought it was. And ultimately for the second series was looking for a partner, and NPR obviously has a great infrastructure for this kind of thing, and they have been great. And this is through their NPR network, and we have a member station working with us as well, which is also one of my old stations, WFAE in North Carolina. So that's the partnership.
Wonderful. I mean, you had to do a deep dive to see if there are parallels of what's happening today politically to the past. And I mean, there are too many presidential elections and primaries to count. I mean, how easy was it for you to get to 1976 and the matchup between Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford?
Yeah, you know, you always have to, history is a continuum. So you always have to just say, where am I going to start? And what is the lens I'm going to look through? And what piece of this am I going to take? And I think that for me this time, the sort of overarching thesis is, look, as a country, we've always been divided. But we have not been divided by party in the way that we are now. So for a lot of American history, the political parties were not ideological vehicles. You didn't have a party of the right, a party of the left. You didn't have the gap between them. There was not an alignment between issues as disparate as building dams in California and abortion, where if you know how someone feels about building dams in California, you may have a good guess on how they feel about abortion, right? I mean, that is a fairly wild and relatively new aspect of American politics. And so that's really what I'm interested in. And that is, I think, something that you can see form very clearly through the 1976 election. And most specifically, you see the Republican Party become a conservative party.
Well, you really dive into Ronald Reagan, California's governor, who obviously went on to become president. And when listening to your podcast, it was really interesting to see the trajectory and how Ronald Reagan evolved from kind of like this fringe candidate to really like a mainstream beloved Republican politician that people, you know, who did support him can still look back on him today and, you know, and like the guy. So one of the things that your podcast does is look about his impact in politics. But can you start off with how he was, you know, pre-governor, pre-presidency, and, you know, his impact today and how he's viewed today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that is one of the things that I'm absolutely fascinated by and became more fascinated by as I got into this series. Because just like you said, Ronald Reagan starts out in entering California politics in 1966, running against Pat Brown, who is the father of Jerry Brown. He was the at that point running for his third term. He'd just beaten Richard Nixon, the former vice president, in a race for California governor. So Pat Brown is, you know, a behemoth. And Reagan enters as not only an actor, I think that usually when we think about it, we think of him as okay, well, he was an actor and therefore he wasn't taken seriously. But the other aspect is just what you said, which was that there was this political side to him. He had burst onto the national stage giving a speech for the 1964 Republican candidate, Barry Goldwater, who was a conservative. And Reagan gave this barn burner of a speech, and it's famous. And it's famous as a political debut. But what is less well remembered is just the message and how sort of extreme it was. What Reagan was saying was that the Great Society is going to end democracy any day now. And so the idea of that sort of viewpoint, and he was a staunch anti-communist who had fed names to the FBI when he was the head of the Screen Actors Guild. And that sort of fear of a communist takeover really drove his ideology. So he was very much on the fringes of American politics. And the way in which he transformed into a viable candidate is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. He really clung on to social issues, and that was successful for him, learning from you in the podcast. Can you explain how those issues were effective for him? I mean, you reminded us of instances where he used this outsider role, you know, from the unrest like Vietnam, free speech protests, even at UC Berkeley.
Yeah, this is a key theme that you hear in the series, and you hear it in this episode about Reagan, but also you hear it later on with another guy called Jimmy Carter, who runs as an outsider. And at the time in politics, when Reagan is running for governor in 66, the idea is that candidates have to have experience, that governing takes know-how. But he is running against the things that government have wrought, and particularly social things. So Reagan had opposed the Civil Rights Act. He'd opposed the Voting Rights Act. He'd opposed fair housing laws in California, all of these as government overreach that were unconstitutional. But of
Even
course,
Medicare,
that is attracting.
What we now know as Medicare.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, you hear some fun tape of Reagan describing this as something that's going to lead to totalitarianism. And so he seizes the social and cultural tumult of the times. Part of it is civil rights. Part of it is race riots that are happening in reaction to civil rights or to the, you know, to racial inequality. Part of it's the Vietnam War, which is growing and reaching its height. And then there are other movements that are beginning to push for more rights as well, more of a voice. You know, you have women's rights. And then you also have the counterculture, right? Like hippie culture that's happening in the 60s. And so Reagan really targets all of these while using the language of sort of anti-tax and government overreach, which gives him some plausible deniability.
Hmm. We do have a clip from episode 2 that I'm going to play, but I want to set it up because, you know, as he is using these social issues to appeal to voters, I mean, there's a lot of emotion that's tied to that. And he ran on this platform of Law and Order and, you know, was very critical of California, saying that it had fallen to this culture of leniency. And so we're going to hear a part where he was skilled at stretching the truth for political gain, because these are emotional issues. So we're going to listen to how he characterized student protests happening at Berkeley.
A small minority of beatniks, radicals, and filthy speech advocates have brought shame on a great university.
His own campaign manager was at first confused by Reagan's fixation on the protesters. Stu Spencer recalled in an oral history his reaction after one early speech.
He really sliced them a piece of ooh, baloney, you really went after him. And we got back to the room, and I says, why are you talking about that? I says, it's a blip in the polls. He looks me right in the eye, and he says, it won't be when I get through. He was right.
Reagan relayed stories about the students that were truly shocking.
As a matter of fact, I have here a copy of a report of the district attorney of Alameda County. It concerns a dance that was sponsored by the Vietnam Day Committee, sanctioned by the university as a student activity, and that was...
He read a description of what we'd now call a rave.
Three rock and roll bands were in the center of the gymnasium, playing simultaneously all during the dance.
He described drugs and sex.
And persons twisted and gyrated in provocative and sensual fashion.
All the worst vices of the hippies.
The smell of marijuana was prevalent all over the entire building.
And if you were a Californian, your tax dollars supported this.
At 2:10 a.m., an electrician had to be summoned by a custodian to cut off the power, which was the only way they could close the gymnasium and get the dance ended.
The story summed up everything Reagan was opposing with his candidacy: a liberal government coddling the unpatriotic anti-war, the lawless, the drug-addled hippies. There was only one problem with this story. It was fiction. The DA whose report Reagan was ostensibly reading said it was totally made up. In fact, Reagan's speeches were littered with exaggerations and outright falsehoods. He favored a compelling story, even if it was fast and loose with the facts.
Yeah, so that story was emotional. As you said, it was compelling. It was not true. It was fiction. But what does this demonstrate about the political strategy here? Because it was successful for him.
Yeah, well, you know, at the very beginning of that clip, you hear his campaign manager at the time, and that's pulled from an oral history done here in California. And his campaign manager says, you know, these are emotional issues. These are highly social issues, highly emotional issues. And that's very different from, I think, what the political parties typically concentrated on at the time. The political parties at the time typically had, you know, liberal factions, conservative factions, people across the spectrum socially and culturally. And so they didn't want to divide those coalitions. And Reagan comes in with a very different strategy, which is to put a new coalition together of people who are concerned about those things. And, you know, the thing that drives us to the polls is how much we care. To take our time out of our day to go and actually cast a ballot. And so he is firing people up with this kind of stuff.
Mm. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and we're talking to creator and host Ben Bradford about his new podcast called Landslide and the Transformation of the Republican Party, in large part thanks to California's Ronald Reagan, also our former president. So the timeliness of this, I mean, is obvious. We are in a presidential election year, that politics has become divisive. That is a word that is used time and time again. Why do you think it's important to listen to Landslide of all years, 2024?
I think that the question that drove me drives a lot of people, which is just trying to understand how we got here. And I think that there are sort of two things that are worth, in addition to the story, which I think is sort of wild and fun and tense, and there are moments that are funny, and I really enjoyed putting it together, and I hope people enjoy listening to it. But the other, thematically, the things that I think are really important are being able to trace the line of what led to today that didn't explode from nowhere. And I think if we can understand the forces that lead us to today, we'll have a better job, we'll be able to do a better job of trying to address them. And being more functional as a society and as a government and all those things. And then the other part of it is that people have told me that going back and listening to the tumult of these times is actually kind of comforting, because it's nice to know that, you know, I don't know whether we've been in a political moment like this one. I would argue we probably haven't, but we have certainly been in some difficult, stressful political moments that mirror this one in many ways.
Mm. You know, when we look back on Reagan, you know, in history, I mean, he was a popular governor. He took out an incumbent, you know, to become California's governor. He was a popular president by, you know, people who voted for him. But it also started off, and this is what I learned from your podcast, this was an underdog story. He was not, I mean, no one would have predicted this if in the beginning when he showed an interest in politics.
Not only when he showed an interest in politics, but throughout his career, when Reagan, you know, the main thrust of the podcast is Reagan challenging Gerald Ford for control of the Republican Party, and then kind of following from there some other underdogs. I mean, again, Jimmy Carter, and then later again Ronald Reagan, and the New York Times wrote in 1976 that Reagan's challenge against Ford, that he had no chance unless you, quote, suspect the Republican Party of suicidal tendencies. So it absolutely is, I think, just an amazing thing to watch how he goes from sort of that image to becoming president of the United States.
I also think about the harm that causes by using perhaps knowingly fiction and appealing to emotion, exploiting that to get votes. How do you think that has impacted how candidates campaign today?
You know, I think there are a lot of things throughout the story, including Reagan's rhetoric, that have become very normalized in American politics. Now, I would also say that he was a transcendent political candidate, and you can still hear it when you go back and listen to him. So I'm not sure anybody matches the force with which he was able to do it. But yeah, I think that the way that almost every issue in this country, regardless of whether it's a policy issue, whether it's about our culture, is all tied up in our politics is something that really has developed from that time.
Hmm. What do you want listeners to take away from your podcast? I mean, just the first four episodes are now released, but you have another three that are going to be coming out.
Yeah, episode four comes out on Thursday, and that focuses on the convention, which this fight between Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, the closest presidential primary race we've ever had. It's called the Shootout in Kansas City. And then after that, we follow some of these other developments that are happening. Again, the rise of Jimmy Carter. And then ultimately, we wind up with kind of the culmination of this in 1980 with Carter against Reagan, these two very unlikely people facing off in an election that I think is very different than probably most people's, you know, memory or idea of it. I hope that people take away some context for analyzing our current race. I mean, I think that understanding our history is so important if we want to understand how we're going to address it.
Yeah. I go back to when you said that some of the response you received is that they felt comforted listening to this podcast because, I mean, there are parallels. So it's although, you know, each election year is unique. How does that make you feel at a time when I think for a lot of people, you know, political coverage and politics in general, people kind of check out. It can be overwhelming and just kind of a bummer. But, you know, a podcast like this not only is important, but it was engaging to people.
I really appreciate that. I mean, I think that is the goal of it, is to take something that maybe we have sort of, you know, fuzzy black and white ideas of, boring old history, and hearing, you know, if you think about our present time and our present feeling toward politics, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is there's a sense of danger in the air, and that existed back then too. And I hope to capture that. And I think that that's one of the things that hopefully you hear in the clips that you've played here, and that people, it seems to be resonating with people in the series.
Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Bradford is a former Cap Radio reporter and the creator and host of the new podcast Landslide, which is part of the NPR network. You can head over to our Insight page on capradio.org, and we have a link to connect you. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Food is more than just a necessity or fuel. Often the meals we eat and grow up with have a story, becoming a source of pride and nostalgia. Food can also be emotional and even a way for us to learn about history that has been long overlooked. Because recipes that begin with one region can over time evolve with migration and, frankly, colonialism. Our next guest went on a journey discovering how food connects us to family, history, conflict, and migration, becoming the first Puerto Rican food columnist in the United States. And that dedication for preserving the diaspora has become her debut book, Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook, which is a visual record of recipes, including some from her own family. The book earned a James Beard Award last summer. Joining us now is writer Ileana Maisonet, ahead of her event at the Sacramento Public Library. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
So I know I'm not alone in this. I loved your cookbook. It was great. I learned so much, but I also left very hungry and also inspired to cook.
That's great.
So I was also loved learning in your intro that you were born and raised in Sacramento. You currently live in San Francisco right now. But I'm curious, starting from the beginning, when did writing and food become a big part of your life?
I'm not necessarily sure or can pinpoint like the exact moment, you know, because it's all so kind of grand. I mean, I feel like writing and cooking are a part of most people's, most families that come from like an immigrant background. Well, Puerto Ricans are considered immigrants because they're United States citizens, but still the experience of coming to the States is very similar to an immigrant's experience, you know. Cooking is not like a very, it's not like, you know, an ethereal thing. It's not a visceral thing. It's just a thing, you know, it's something that you have to do. So it's something that I've been looking in and around all my life.
Yeah. I mean, one of the quotes or what you wrote that stood out to me when talking about your Nana, your grandma and your mother, and there's photos of them, you know, leading your book with you as a child, was that, you know, the pleasure of cooking didn't really exist. You know, it was right out of necessity.
Exactly.
But that also shaped, I'm curious, did that also shape your desire for food as also a vehicle to retain history and to tell history the right way?
Yeah, but I mean, that didn't come till much, much later, you know, like cooking is a very domestic thing in my family, in my culture, you know, to, that's like saying, you know, you grew up to be, I don't know, like a laundromat owner, you know what I mean? Like it's a very domestic thing. So I think like the concept of, maybe of connecting food and storytelling really didn't come until much, much later in my life.
It reminds me of, you know, my abuela, she's from Mexico, would obviously cook for all of the children. That was, you know, she it was a traditional role. And my grandmother as well, who's Japanese and from Japan. They're great cooks. We love their food. But when I was a teenager, I remember asking them, do you enjoy cooking? And they would be like, you know, they would kind of pause. And that was like one of the first realizations for me as someone young, that just because you're good at something does not mean that you enjoy it. Have you always enjoyed cooking food, about learning about the history and the generations behind the recipes of your family?
Again, those things, they did not come until much, much later. Like, basically, none of these things really came into my mind before maybe like 2009 when I went to culinary school. You know, like, there are just not... All these things are very, all the things that you're mentioning right now are very poetic. Do you know what I mean? But it's also coming from a very kind of like a romanticized background. And to see cooking as romantic was not a thing. So literally none of those things existed in my puny human brain before I turned 30.
When did the wheel start turning then for you? I would imagine, you know, while or after culinary school, when you started thinking about this book, Dias Puerto Rican?
I didn't start thinking until the book until 2014. I started thinking about writing. I had already done some writing long before I became like a visual artist. Like both of my parents are visual artists, you know, so art has always been a part of my life. You know, my mom does not, to this day, does not really like to cook. So the cooking kind of came from my grandma, which is why I have like a very specific sort of relationship with food in the terms of that I see someone cooking for me or sharing food with me as kind of like, you know, like an expression of love. And when it comes to writing, you know, that's very much a part of both of my parents' lives. So when I went to culinary school, it didn't take me long to figure out that being a lifer in the kitchen in the back of the house was probably not what I wanted to do, you know, as like a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old living that life. I knew that that was not going to be something that I wanted for myself. So around the same time, I'd already read some of the magazines like, you know, Gourmet with Ruth Reichel and Bon Appetit and Sever and all those things. But I don't really think that being a writer, a food writer, really clicked for me until the Lucky Peach magazine came out and then kind of Anthony Bourdain hit the scene. It was then and there and I was like, oh, okay, we can write about food in a much different way, you know, in a similar way that like, you know, all the great classic white males write about their adventures, like E. Cummings and Hemingway and Kerouac. Like, we can write about food like that, and in not the way that, no shade to Ruth Reichel or to M.K.A. Fisher, but those types of writing are very ethereal, very fairy-like, you know? And while I love them, I don't necessarily connect with them. I don't see myself in them.
Yeah, I appreciate the way that you write. It's like I feel like I'm sitting across the table from you and having a very honest conversation about, you know, what you're passionate about, what you want to share with readers. When you started, you know, in 2014, which was like a decade ago, when Diasporican began taking shape, how did you want to approach telling the history of Puerto Rican food? Because, you know, it is a history that is, you can't just put in a box, and it's hard to define.
I mean, there's no way, in my personal opinion, there's no real way to talk about Puerto Rican food without talking about the history of Puerto Rico. Like, it's just, for me, it's just very hard to do, you know? So the way that I write about it is just very, I don't know. It's just very so, if that makes any sense. You know what I mean? Like, it's literally just me writing how I have researched it. Because it took a lot of research, you know, not just a lot of research by being there, which is also true, but also took a lot of research, you know, kind of like in the academic, you know, academic format.
And before that, I mean, you were the first columnist in the United States to write about Puerto Rican food. What has the
response? Which is also accidental. It's all totally accidental. Like, if you would have asked me if I would have been here in 2009, I would have said absolutely not. Like, it's all, and I mean, that's pretty much most of my life. I find that most of the things that happen to me are all through, like, these weird transitional periods where I just kind of happen to be in the right place at the right time. Because, you know, it's like that phrase, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. I'm always ready.
Yeah.
So when I see this moment, it's kind of like I just slipped through there. And it's the same way with, you know, writing the book. Like, when I became a columnist at the Chronicle, it was totally accidental. Like, I was already doing some, they found me, like, in 2006 or something like that, early on, when I was doing pop-ups. Or maybe, I don't even know, it was so long ago. I used to do Puerto Rican pop-ups in San Francisco, and that's how they found me, and they wrote about me. And then they asked me to just kind of write a little small blurb, you know, during the holidays. And then I pitched them 1 year and I said, you know, like, I'd like to write about Puerto Rican restaurants in Northern California because there's so few Puerto Rican restaurants, you know, in the country, really, even though Puerto Ricans are like the second largest Latino demographic in the United States. And like, they're now at like 5.9 million, which is more than on the island itself, you know, so they were like, sure, okay, that's great. And I, at the time, there were already other columnists there, like Nick Sharma, writing about like their own cultural foods. So I kind of took a cue from that and I said, hey, what if I wrote like a column? What do you think about an idea for a column about Puerto Rican food? But from kind of like, you know, from the diaspora perspective, which really didn't exist at the time. And luckily, I just happened to have the right editor there, Paolo Lucchesi, and he was like, yeah, sounds good. Let's do it.
Hmm. You have over 90 recipes in your cookbook, and some are part of your family as well. I look at the cover. I mean, the cover is wonderful, as it should be. It's a cover. I mean, the flavor just jumps off the page. I mean, the colors are vibrant. I was able to find out, you know, what it was. It was arepas de coco with ensalada de pulpo y camarones, which is octopus and shrimp. I'm curious about who is holding the food. Who are those hands?
Oh, those are my mom's hands.
Wonderful. You know, and I know that this was, these moments are moments that you stumbled upon because you are ready, you know, and you were prepared for these moments. But given that this has received, you know, such a wonderful response, I mean, you received a James Beard Award, and then it's a popular book. People love taking it in. What does that mean to you? What does that level of response mean to you?
I mean, by the way, that cover, also accidental, but I just wanted to mention that too. Also accidental. I just think that it means that it's like a gift and a curse, because it means that all those years that I was, you know, pushing for the book proposal to fall into the right hands, and literally everyone responding, you know, there's no market for it, there's no market for you, kind of means that I guess that there was after all.
What do you hope people, readers, learn about the people and the history and the food of Puerto Ricans from the perspective of the diaspora?
That it's probably a lot more complex than they have been told or thought or anticipated, and that it definitely cannot be put into a very kind of neat little box.
What do you enjoy? Finally, this is our last question. We only have like a minute left. I mean, you were going to be speaking at the Sacramento Public Library this evening, but you've also held virtual cooking demos as well. I mean, what do you enjoy about doing events like this and introducing this to other people?
That's basically what I enjoy, is introducing Puerto Rican food to other people.
Ileana, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Ileana Masonette is a James Beard Award-winning writer of Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook. She'll be at an event this evening at the Sacramento Public Library. We have more information on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky, managing editor Aram Sarkissian, our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our original show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Wednesday. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.